You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. Welcome to the V3 Podcast with Dr. Ann Arvizu. Medical affairs innovators are changing the game for business success and making the world a better place for our patients. On the V3 Podcast, we showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. Each month, join host Dr. Ann Arvizu, a globally recognized medical affairs subject matter expert and awarded biotech industry executive veteran, for powerful interviews with today's acclaimed innovators and founders who are leading the profession forward into a new era. These high-level conversations will leave you inspired and equipped with future-focused ideas for changing culture and making an impact. And now, here's Anne.
Welcome back to another episode of the V3 Podcast. This is the future of medical affairs. Once again, I'm Anne Arvizu, your host, and I'm glad you are listening. One of the powers of podcasting is bringing together experts for a conversation that needs to be had. I love and value being in a position to use my voice to showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs as catalysts for global change. I received a question this past month from one of our listeners. They asked if I'm being paid to podcast, and the answer is no. Here's my motivation. I take time to do this in order to raise awareness of issues that are cornerstones to all of us in drug development, clinical research, and medical affairs. The key issue that I'm raising today is a humanity problem, one of an unlikely suspect: antibiotics, the necessity for them, and the resistance to them. On August 30th last year, an article came out entitled, "Antibiotic Resistance Could Kill Us Before Climate Change." That article was picked up globally and went viral on multiple major news outlets such as Sky News, Euronews, MSN, and Fast Company, to name a few. And it's been said that if this urgent problem isn't tackled, that in our not-so-distant future, we could see over 10 million lives a year lost globally to antibiotic resistance. The issue is one of the biggest public health challenges of our time. Now, if I asked you that just a few minutes ago before I started talking, would you have been able to verbalize that as healthcare professionals? Probably not. Let me give you a little bit more perspective. Each year in the U.S. alone, at least 2.8 million people get an antibiotic-resistant infection, and more than 35,000 people die, according to the CDC. We need a global collaborative approach. Here, as a quick comparison regarding the recent news about the coronavirus, as of today, as of this recording, which is mid-February, it was reported that 1,100 people have died in China and 35,000 people in China and other nations have been infected. And I won't minimize one of those deaths. This was a sudden and vicious outbreak. And nor will I compare a virus to a bacteria, but I will comment on the fact that there was such a rapid and global awareness campaign about this virus. And yet, for something so insidious like antibiotic resistance, we really don't know the threat that's right under our nose. Another statistic is that in the U.S. alone, I've heard the coronavirus compared to the flu virus. While the impact of the flu varies widely from year to year, and statistics are based on, you know, evidential reporting, it places a substantial burden on the health of people in the United States each year. So, for example, the CDC has ranges of estimates that influenza has resulted between 9 to 45 million illnesses, between 140,000 to 810,000 hospitalizations, and between 12,000 and 61,000 deaths annually since 2010. But that's an annual look rather than this coronavirus, which we're tracking month over month. We still don't know what the impact will be as it spreads and it's continuing to spread to other countries. However, compare that 10 million deaths due to antibiotic resistance in the not so distant future. We need education and we need awareness now across fronts to combat fear. Many years ago, probably 1998 or 1999, I went to my first antibiotic conference. That's a nice way to say ICAC. It stands for the Interscience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy. And as an anti-infective specialist at the time when I was creating global clinical studies for an AECB trial, I saw data that was beyond my reference point that blew my mind, not only as a pharmacist, but as a global clinical study leader. It's eye-opening when you hear stories and case studies of patients that are just mind-boggling, that you can think, how did that patient get that if they've never been treated by an antibiotic? It's even more horrifying to see it firsthand. I once had to be part of an ethics committee in a hospital that needed to stop an adult son with power of attorney from keeping his mother on life support for poor a month past what all the hospital leadership and physicians felt was correct. He insisted she kept being pumped full of antibiotics as well as a host of other medications. And I witnessed a young surgeon on rotation have to go into her MRSA room all gowned up to perform yet another amputation. I believe it was her third. It was horrible. The Infectious Disease Society of America showcases patient stories such as this from children to adults. And for your information, all the links that we mentioned today in this podcast will be posted below. I hope to raise awareness among pharmacists, physicians, the public, other healthcare professionals, and beyond the typical stakeholder spectrum with this episode. As many of you in our Pharmacy Podcast Nation might know, I'm not in pharmacy practice in hospital or retail. I've been in the biotech industry for 23 years. And I'd love to hear your voice in the comments and on social media about this topic, because you're seeing something we're not, and we're seeing something you're not from the research side. We need our voices together. Hailing from the pharma and biotech world, I'm not behind the counter in the community or in the hospital pharmacy, but as the leader of a communications and medical consulting firm, I get to mentor and partner with multiple pharmaceutical companies every year at the senior executive level. And I consistently get to engage in these conversations of global need across multiple therapeutic areas. There are some very noble and passionate and caring and knowledgeable researchers out there that top this field. And I'm privileged to have one of them on this podcast today as our featured guest. Her name is Dr. Jill Massey. She's Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs at Melinta Therapeutics, and she's a PharmD, and she's a she. Dr. Massey has 27 years of medical affairs experience in the commercialization and lifecycle management of pharmaceutical products across multiple therapeutic areas, including infectious diseases. She's recognized for her expertise in strategic planning, collaborative partnerships, and effective business integrations across business functions. Throughout her career, Jill has focused on creating value-based medical affairs solutions and external alliances. She's also held leadership roles at J&J, Janssen, and BMS. In her role of Senior Vice President at Medical Affairs at Melinta, Jill is responsible for promoting responsible and sustainable use of Melinta's antibiotics through data generation, real-world evidence and dissemination, and developing external strategic alliances with professional organizations and societies. If you are a non-medical affairs professional, you might not know that what goes on from research and development to medical affairs is very, very in-depth to try to educate not only the healthcare professional, but the patient as well. I'm thrilled to bring you her voice and vision today here on the V3 podcast. Jill earned her PharmD degree from the University of Nebraska and her MBA from Drexel. She's also held a faculty position at St. Louis College of Pharmacy. She's a well-spoken expert and educator. And as we initially got together to discuss this podcast, we were 100% aligned and on the same page with the topic for today. I kind of hinted, but I want to highlight that Jill is a woman executive and the first woman guest that we have here on the V3 podcast. So I'm proud of her as a woman executive and a PharmD in senior leadership. As such, she's actually an exception to the rule in our industry, so I want to acknowledge her success because it's exciting and it's important to highlight that since most companies are predominantly still governed at the top two levels by men. One final note. Although my microphone was light during the recording, all our equipment was running and my microphone light was on during the recording, but somehow Murphy's Law crept into this recording and recording equipment failed on my side, on my track. We lost some of Jill's audio on her side. We lost a bit of audio on my side at one point. There must have been a bad connection, but at least we salvaged a backup of the ambient recording via the computer. So the sound might not be perfect at all, but we will at least get our point across today. So I thank my magical team of podcast editors in advance for your help with the sound as much as possible. Jill sounds great, and for me, that's the most important part. Join us in progress as we dive right in and I get Jill's opinion on the big questions that loom over us today.
Well, hi, Jill. Welcome. Thanks for coming on the V3 podcast today. It's great to talk with you again.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you.
No worries. This is great. I think we're going to have a great conversation today. You know, as we've talked about before, we have a 911 crisis on our hands, don't we, globally? And it's funny that counterintuitively to some people, the lack of new antibiotics has been deemed the biggest threat to the entire global situation of antibiotics, resistance, overuse, et cetera. I have the time to talk with you today, and we have our listeners that really want to hear from an expert. What is your take on the lack of new antibiotics and what we can do as a whole, as healthcare professionals, as medical affairs professionals, and even as patients that tune in to listen to the V3 podcast? What do we need to know and what do we need to do?
Well, I think first we have to agree on the causality of the issue. So it's important to understand that what we're talking about when we talk about antimicrobial resistance is resistance of the bacteria to the antibiotics that we are using to eradicate the bacteria. And this is a, as you know, a natural phenomenon that occurs over time. Unfortunately, that those time periods are shortening as the bacteria get smarter, so to speak, but would be expected with repeated exposure to any antibiotic. And now we're even seeing that when you are not necessarily exposed to an antibiotic directly, but may be consuming antibiotic-treated chicken or red meat or whatever. So it's a far bigger issue than certainly just for the human population, but that anybody actually realizes now. And then that gets you to the question of, well, where are the new and innovative antibiotics that we have always discovered and made available for patients who need them? And the unfortunate truth about that is because the antibiotic development programs that are targeting pathogens today, those that have been identified as critical and urgent threats to the human population by the World Health Organization and the CDC, those pathogens are rare now, which is the good news. The bad news is that as we set up our drug development programs, which, of course, as you know, are very expensive, we've talked about that as well, and they are targeting these rare-to-find pathogens, and that's very costly. Those programs are very costly because you may need to screen 600 patients to find one patient infected with that pathogen that meets the inclusion-exclusion criteria of your randomized controlled trial. So they're expensive, they're lengthy, and once those antibiotics get to the market, the populations of patients, thankfully, that they're targeted or intended to treat are few right now. And so the return on investment, if you will, from the commercialization of those products is minimal.
Right.
For that reason, large pharmaceutical companies are mostly getting out of that business as they choose to focus on other more profitable life-saving treatments as well. And that drives investors and the investment community away from the antibiotics industry. Mm-hmm. So the funding of the development of those antibiotics is very difficult to come by, and certainly funding of commercialization efforts where we're trying to educate people on appropriate use of those antibiotics is also drying up. As a result of that, a lot of companies have stopped their development programs out of necessity, and we have fewer and fewer antibiotics, certainly innovative antibiotics, being developed that will be available once those pathogens that, again, are of high priority and urgent threats identified by our organizations are necessarily to be treated by these companies.
Yep. Yeah, and Melinta is one of them, unfortunately, and this is part of the problem. And what's your take on that? I mean, what can we do to help companies get that funding back or bring awareness to the fact that this is an absolute solution to the problem?
Yes. Yeah, so as you mentioned, one of the unfortunate casualties has been the Melinta Development Program. So as we filed Chapter 11, in order to fund our currently available, commercially available antibiotics that we have, we had to divest of our early discovery program. Mm-hmm. What can we do about this? Well, first and foremost, I think for the public health reasons, we need to practice good infection control, things like washing your hands, not demanding antibiotics from your healthcare provider when they're diagnosing you with a viral infection.
Yes.
Simple things like that. From our perspective, we are lobbying for several legislative actions to help fund or infuse some financing into the antibiotic industry, one of which is the Disarm Act, which would remove antibiotics from the bundled hospital payment system known as the DRG and allow reimbursement separately so that healthcare providers could use the right antibiotic in the right patient at the right time, mm-hmm. instead of substituting with less expensive but also less effective and more toxic generic antibiotics as a cost-saving measure.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about that switch with a generic, why would the generic be more toxic?
There's a lot in our pivotal trials. We always compare ourselves to the standard of care, which is typically now a generic agent, since antibiotics have been on the market for a long time. And all of those trials do show that the antibiotic that is the standard of care is either less effective or equally effective but more toxic than the new innovative drug. And that's across all sponsors. I'm not just saying that about Melinta's antibiotics or any one company's antibiotics. That's the standard randomized controlled trial threshold that we must meet for approval.
Right.
And so because the new innovative antibiotic may have less, let's just say, renal toxicity or whatever that toxicity is, but costs significantly more, in order to recoup the discovery and development funds, that's why healthcare providers will use a less expensive generic because they're still effective. They just may have a higher incidence of adverse events or whatnot, and they're far less expensive mm-hmm. because they have cost constraints in their hospitals as well.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, years ago I worked on FACTIV as a global clinical trial leader and writing those types of protocols. You're absolutely right. That's the type of data you do get back in. We really need education, and we need awareness, I believe, across all fronts to combat fear, but also to bring some startling data to light. I remember back in 1998, 1999, going to conferences such as ICAC and seeing startling data, right? And that's way back when, if you have it. I haven't been, you know, at the forefront of antibiotics like you are now, but seeing data presented on patients, young children in Puerto Rico that are prey to antibiotic resistance before they've ever been even given an antibiotic because of food sources. You mentioned food sources. Fish sources are something else, right? Farmed fish with just antibiotics dumped in there. The pork industry was just slammed last year on some of their issues. And trying to engage other healthcare professionals, such as veterinarians, who have to provide this antibiotic dosage. It's just, it's a magnitude proportion across multiple industries, not just us in healthcare, and then even more specifically in pharma, biopharma, biotech. How can we specifically in biotech create some awareness or create educational programs? If you were able to do this, or you are doing this, where's the starting point, and where is the critical mass where, you know, you can see change potentially happening?
So I'm pleased that we are doing this in a couple of ways. One is BIO, which is our trade association, has sponsored some educational initiatives that are reaching the lay media and lay press to get the word out more strongly than we have in the past. Secondly, there are the CDC in its One Health initiative, you know, tackles this issue with a lot of educational materials that are targeted towards all of those different stakeholders that you just mentioned. Any organization can participate in to demonstrate how they are, what specifically they are doing to tackle this antimicrobial resistance problem. And you'll see many pharmaceutical companies, you'll see individual healthcare providers, you'll see microbiologists, and anybody across the board that, which is all of us, by the way, that are stakeholders in this problem of public health and public concern can participate in their challenge. And so they do a lot to, as well, broadcast the problem and then potential solutions by sharing these best practices across organizations. There are several organizations such as the Access to Medicine Foundation that is that are also drawing attention to the issue. They are bodies that measure how, in this case specifically, pharmaceutical companies are behaving with regard to antimicrobial stewardship. And they specifically assess us on our research and development programs, on our manufacturing and supply to ensure that we are not inappropriately affecting wastewater or dumping antibiotics and contributing to resistance in our water supply, as well as our education and promotional efforts and ensuring that we are doing that appropriately and not just advocating for volume of antibiotics, but really targeting, again, the right drug for the right patient at the right time. These organizations publish their results, and so their reports are publicly available, again, just underscoring the issue of antimicrobial resistance and the broad spectrum of stakeholders that are involved in this.
Excellent. I love when people bring up our tagline, too, which is the right drug to the right patient at the right time since 2004.
Right.
It is so good to hear from leaders like you that understand this big global issue. What is a fear we need to get over, and how can we get over it? How can we collectively bring awareness and mindset globally, not just within these stakeholder communities, but to the public at large and to underserved communities and people that don't have access maybe to information or wouldn't think about having access to medical information? You know, patients that are in socioeconomic distress, for example, patients with special needs, etc., that really this is not at the forefront of what they need to know, so they might never know it. And like you said, people are asking in all these different scenario. So what is the biggest fear that we're dealing with globally in your perspective?
I think the biggest one globally is really access to the right antibiotics. So whether you're talking about a poor or disadvantaged individual patient in any country or our country, or if you're talking about a low or middle income country as a whole, ensuring that they have a ready supply of the appropriate antibiotics and are treated appropriately with good infection control is, the number one cure for this, one of these issues, right, that we're talking about. So when you don't have access to the right antibiotics, then you use inferior products or products that might not have the susceptibility patterns that you would normally use to treat an infection of that type. And that just then causes additional, it interferes with, you know, the microbiome and causes additional or subsequent consequences that you weren't necessarily planning on. I think I can't underscore the importance of infection control. So, yeah. You know, educating on the basics, wash your hands, yes. You know, don't overuse or demand an antibiotic for every time you have a symptom that may or may not be a bacterial infection. And those are really the, I think that's what an individual's fear is. Oh, I have a scratchy throat or I have a cough. I need an antibiotic. That's the knee-jerk reaction. And typically they'll get an antibiotic for that. And so over-prescribing, inappropriate prescribing, that's the other fear. And in a lot of cases, we see broad spectrum antibiotics used when a very narrow spectrum against a very targeted pathogen would be the more appropriate choice. And that broad spectrum antibiotic, as you would assume, has unintended consequences to it and just contributes to the issue of antimicrobial resistance.
That's a great insight. And you know, you mentioned hand washing, right? Effective infection prevention and control, IPC, hand hygiene. There are multiple, obviously outside of regular antibiotic use, we have anti-infectives, right? Antivirals and acquired through either sexual misuse or vaccination, right? Vaccination is another way,
yes,
to contain.
Yes.
People think of vaccination like flu vaccine to prevent flu or virus, but you're talking measles, tetanus, meningitis, typhoid, other diseases that are preventable by vaccination, which are antimicrobial in nature. Food hygiene, clean water, sanitation issue, and teaching patient populations about prudent use, which is something you touched on, right? And it's about people with immunodeficiencies, for example, as well. You have different patient populations and ways that we can educate, that we can find out more, that we can bring all the stakeholders to the table together, water sanitation issues, et cetera, and leaders. This is a $100 trillion U.S. dollar economic output issue. And that's the risk due to the rise of drug-resistant infections. You know, you talked before about the high cost and then the long term of doing the types of trials that get us the types of antibiotics that will actually help solve this issue. And again, I started off this podcast saying, this sounds like it's counterintuitive. Why do we need more? We need more because some of the older ones are more toxic in nature. They do have higher side effect profiles than they did in the past when they were first starting to be used. And the gold standard is changing. Antibiotics have not changed much over the past couple of decades. And all of a sudden, there's a fire of a situation. So any parting thoughts for our listeners and for the medical affairs community of what can be done next together, or what a vision maybe that you have for the world could be?
I think a short-term next step is that I think the population in general, doesn't matter what stakeholder you are, can lobby your legislators to pass the legislation. It's called the Disarm Act, that is on their desk today, that would give the opportunity for healthcare providers in hospitals to use the right antibiotic at the right time and the right patient, right? That's the short-term thing. I think once the commercialization conundrum, if you will, is at least partially solved, then these companies will have the ability to fund further research and development to, again, bring more of these innovative antibiotics to the marketplace. But I think the core fundamentals that we've been talking about are the key takeaways. You know, good infection control, prudent use of antibiotics, targeted use of antibiotics. So know what pathogen you're treating and use the right drug for that pathogen are really important things. And, you know, with regard to antibiotic use in animals, it's a complex issue as well, that we shouldn't demand antibiotic-free animals because we want infected animals to be treated with antibiotics. The key is infected animals. We don't want to be using antibiotics for growth and production purposes. We want to use it for treating illnesses just like we would in humans. Yeah. And it's really this, you know, be aware, educate yourself. The CDC has great resources online to educate the spectrum of stakeholders, from the consumer to the healthcare provider to organizations. Your organization, they offer these for you to use, and you can download their materials and disseminate them at your discretion. So it's a great resource. But to your point, it starts with awareness. And that's really the biggest hurdle we're trying to get over right now.
It really is. Jill, thank you for helping us and helping me get this message across. It is a timely message. It is a threat globally to us. And we are one big human family. I live in South Florida, so that is kind of the tagline of the people of Key West, that we're one big human family, and we need to worry about these issues together as one. Going back to our earlier point, I just want to close with the fact that, you know, we have, and it's been listed in the WHO, as well as what we spoke about today and what you've brought to the table, that, you know, there's many reports revealing a very weak pipeline for antibiotic agents. And when we have a company like Melinta that's completely 100% focused on antibiotics and you know, just, you know, using what you have to treat patients with, but not being able to beef up that pipeline, that there's really only 60 products in development globally, about 50 antibiotics and 10 biologics, bringing little benefit over existing treatments, and few targeting the most critical and resistant bacteria, especially gram negatives. And like you said, it's so hard to get those 600 patients into a trial to find out what is that most next effective agent. And we have to try together. So private investors, the knowledge of the lack of innovation going on here in the development of new antibiotics, that undermines efforts to combat drug-resistant infections, that, you know, this is what the WHO is trying to stress as well. All of the links that Jill and I talked about today will be on the notes below. So thank you. You can access them here. I'm going to put a host of great information from the WHO, from the World Health Organization, et cetera, from the CDC, and from other great resources that you might want to look into for your own practice. So thank you for listening today. And Jill, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure speaking with you as well. And, you know, one point I just wanted to, you made me think of this as you were talking about this being a global threat. It's also, you know, there's other specialties or professions that are impacted by this. You know, when you think about patients receiving chemotherapy, the criticality of the availability of effective antibiotics, or you wouldn't be able to receive certain chemotherapies, is really important. Dental procedures, elective surgeries, even critical surgeries, all these things would be impacted if effective antibiotics are not continuously produced. So it's not just, you know, we're not just talking about a, you know, skin infection that you might have today. We're talking about other things, a tooth extraction that you might need tomorrow that you're going to need effective antibiotics for.
Yes. This is really good. This is a great point. And thank you for that last point. I have so enjoyed our conversation today. We literally could talk about this topic for the next
week. We could.
We really could. It is so big and so broad. And I look forward to getting comments from some of our listeners. And thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the V3 Podcast, part of the ACMA Podcast Series, in collaboration with the Pharmacy Podcast Network. For all of the ACMA podcasts, please go to acmapodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. If you enjoy the leading podcast network dedicated to the business and profession of pharmacy, please write us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know which channel is your favorite. And remember, the pharmacist is the hub of healthcare.